when his country was at war and he was of able mind and body. This is what Rees did. He would have liked nothing more than for future generations to never experience war. He also knew that if history was any indication, war was something to always prepare for. Rees stripped off his blood and sweat-soaked camis, dropping them onto the floor of the condo's garage. He broke down his M4 for cleaning, the insides caked with carbon blowback from using the suppressor. As per his post-op ritual, he replaced the batteries in his NODs, ATPL laser, and flashlight. His helmet, along with his rifle, went to the bedroom with him. Be prepared, Rees. He leaned the carbine against the nightstand and picked up his phone for a signal and Spider Oak check. With no activity on either account, he shut it down before showering off the blood, dirt, and grime of the past few hours, until finally pulling the sheets over his head to grab a few hours of much-needed rest. Bang, bang, bang! Rees rolled out of bed and grabbed his M4, training the suppressed muzzle on the bedroom door. He heard a muffled voice that sounded like it was coming from the top of the steps outside. It's me, bro! Let me in! Bang, bang, bang! Rees lowered the muzzle and shook his head. Fucking Ben. Holding the M4 loosely at his side by the pistol grip, he walked out of the bedroom wearing a t-shirt and boxers to let his friend in through the front door. Viva Mexico! I brought you some tacos. Wasn't sure if you had time to stop and eat while you were down there. Ben was as chipper as ever. He looked Rees up and down and winced. Do you just hang out all day in your drawers now, bro? Just trying to get some sleep, Rees answered wearily. Still haven't shaved? You're not going hipster on me, are you? Though it does nicely compliment those undies. Do you think you're going back to Afghanistan or something? Or something, Rees muttered, still waking up. Dude, you have the three-letter agencies going crazy, Ben continued, throwing a fat dip of Copenhagen into his mouth. Your little excursion to Margaritaville has the DEA and my people all excited. They have no idea what the story is. The DEA thinks the Sinaloa cartel is making a big move on New Generation, and the CIA is convinced that the Zetas made the hit and are trying to push their way into Baja. They definitely don't know it was some gringo from San Diego who hangs around in his underwear all day. It was good, Ben. I got the men that killed Lauren and Lucy. Rees struggled. And I found out some other stuff that's going to blow your mind. Rees took a bite of his taco and waited until he'd swallowed to finish his thought. This whole thing was some kind of shady clinical trial. Capstone Capital is promising those involved billions, and they've sold their souls for cash. Are you sure? Ben asked. Absolutely. This shit goes really high up the food chain. Even Pilsner was involved. He's the one who put the drug into my troop and ultimately the one who sold us out overseas. They have new trials underway right now with a new group of SEALs. I just can't figure out the mechanics of how they got us ambushed in Afghanistan. I can, Ben replied with uncharacteristic seriousness. We watch a lot of the big Islamic groups in the States for obvious reasons. Big mosques, charity groups, that sort of thing. We're not supposed to work on U.S. soil, but we do it interagency style, so it's all legal. Of course, lots of innocent people come and go in those communities, but every once in a while, there's something that doesn't fit. A few months ago, I saw some traffic on a Navy 06 making regular visits to an Islamic charity group in San Diego. It's one thing to have some enlisted guy decide he's going to follow Allah, but a high-level officer to start meeting with questionable Muslim groups is out of the ordinary. You want to know who the 06 was? You know I do. Captain Leonard Howard, the Admiral's Jag. Fuck me. No, fuck him, bro. His visits with the Imam stopped just before you guys got ambushed overseas. They haven't met together since. Rees had another name to add to his list. This thing looks like a target package, Rees stated, taking the thick file from Ben and beginning to leaf through it. That's because it is, bro. Everything you need is in there. The imam that Howard met with is Hamadi Ismail Massoud. He lives in the mosque. It is more of a mini compound, really, though surprisingly open. You would think they would be a bit more security conscious. They call it the Islamic Center for Peace and Prosperity of Southern California. The mosque should clear out Wednesday after Ishu. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, evening prayer.
When does it go down this time of year? 9:30. It will be fairly packed, but we'll empty out quickly. I've already set you up with an alias and a backstory. You even have an appointment with Masood after prayer, so you have 2 days to get ready. Reese eyed Ben quizzically.
That's not really my style.
Trust me, this will work. This is what I do now, remember?
What, set up assassinations of Islamic clergy on U.S. soil?
Reese, we missed this one. We had this guy in our sights for over a year, and we missed it. If we hadn't, maybe your troop would still be alive. Your government let you down. We knew this guy was as bad as they come. Outwardly, he condemns terrorism and is the face of moderate Islam in Southern California, posting videos on YouTube disparaging Islamic extremists and calling for an end to violence. In reality, his group is a conduit for funneling money to ISIS. I'm talking millions of dollars. While he preaches peace, his money helps ISIS behead Americans on camera for the world to see.
I thought ISIS was focused on Iraq, Syria, and the Levant. Why would Howard go through an ISIS guy to set up an attack in Afghanistan?
Don't be fooled, bro. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not as far apart ideologically as it would seem. It's all about the caliphate, man. 12th century shit. ISIS used to be AQ in Iraq, remember?
Oh, I remember,
Reese said, thinking of the blood and energy he and his men had invested in hunting them down over the years. But I thought they had a very public split not long ago.
Well, they did.
ISIS is the new kid on the block, very popular and far surpassing AQ in fundraising. That, along with their vicious attacks on Shia and even moderate Sunnis, have run counter to more recent AQ proclamations of Islamic unity. They appeal to the next generation of jihadi and are much more adept at recruiting, specifically using social media, than AQ ever was. AQ's message was to join up because Islamic lands are under attack by the West. ISIS flipped it around.
Their messaging is all about being on the offensive.
Very powerful stuff and something we haven't even begun to counter.
That doesn't answer the question as to why Howard and Pilsner used them instead of AQ or Taliban.
That question is exactly why they went the ISIS route to throw people off the track. Logically, it would make sense to use an AQ or Taliban-affiliated network, but if you want to throw up a roadblock, use ISIS.
Unbelievable, Reese said, shaking his head.
Recently, ISIS and AQ leadership have recognized the power of collaboration. They can be a much more effective force if their energies are focused on destroying us instead of each other. Pilsner and Howard have access to the same intelligence channels that I do, and they would have known the same thing. ISIS and AQ can channel resources and kill us today, then work out their differences tomorrow.
So the government wants Masood dead and you figured I'm a good guy to get it done?
Not exactly, brother. Though he does need to die. This guy has funded more terrorism than the blind sheik ever could have hoped to back in the day, yet he promotes himself as a moderate Muslim, denouncing all violence and terrorism. He was the connection to the Pakistani Taliban who planned and executed the ambush of your troop in Afghanistan. I know you are going to take him down. Least I can do is help. My superiors don't know anything about this. It's totally off the books.
So how does the alias and backstory work?
Reese asked, back on task. You are a graduate student at USD in international business and have an elective world comparative religion class. You want to interview Masood for a paper you are writing on world religions and politics. Part of the mandate for their Islamic Center is outreach, so this is not an odd request. They are very open and inviting. I have Masood's cell and center business phone numbers under surveillance. If he calls to check out your creds at USD, I divert the call and confirm your enrollment in graduate school.
Ben smiled, obviously quite proud of himself.
And do me a favor, Ben continued, handing Reese a small package. Leave this with the fucker when you kill him. Wish I could go with you on this one, buddy. Hypocrites drive me crazy.
Reese had checked and double-checked his gear for the next phase of his mission of vengeance. All there was to do now was wait. But there was somewhere that he needed to go first. He steered his cruiser through a quiet neighborhood and parked at a small church, continuing on foot. The streets were deserted at this late hour. Anyone attempting to follow him in a vehicle would be easy to spot. Still, he took an indirect route, winding his way through a maze of residential streets, the silence broken only by the occasional barking dog. His path took him down an alley where he stopped and pretended to tie his shoe. Satisfied that no one was behind him, he cut between two homes and paused at the base of a large eucalyptus tree. Grabbing onto the lowest branch, he scrambled up the trunk and straddled a massive fork. Taking off his pack, Reese removed his bump helmet with its attached NODs, securing them to his head. The dark suburban scene was suddenly bright green through his goggles, thanks to the amplified illumination of the half-moon and stars. He scooted out on the branch until his feet dangled over a wooden privacy fence. Taking advantage of his night vision and his elevated perch, Reese carefully scanned the area for any sign of movement. Seeing nothing out of place, he swung his leg over the limb and dropped into the soft grass of his backyard. Drawing the Glock from his waistband, Reese moved to a knee and took in the scene silently for a full 2 minutes. The house was dark and appeared from the outside to be undisturbed since he'd last left it. He walked across the yard and peered over the side gate toward the front of the house, where he saw Lauren's Cherokee in the driveway and the police tape still strung around the massive eucalyptus that had been the centerpiece of his lawn. The base of the tree had been converted into a makeshift shrine by the neighbors, with cards, handwritten notes, candles, and stuffed animals covering a significant portion of the front yard. Reese holstered his Glock and activated the IR illumination on the side of his helmet before retrieving a Strider SMF folding knife from his pants pocket. Seeing no sign of a booby trap, Reese slipped the knife's blade between the upper and lower panes to the window of his small guest room, disengaging the lock. "Here goes nothing." Reese slid the lower pane upward. The window opened easily. Nothing exploded. Reese exhaled in relief. He took off his pack and lowered it through the window. 20 years of training and more than a decade of urban combat had taught Reese that there is no graceful way for a grown man to climb through a window. He boosted himself up and rolled forward through the opening. The Glock came out, and Reese slowly and painstakingly cleared his home, room by room and closet by closet. Moving into Lucy's room, Reese removed his helmet and sat on the tiny bed, surrounded by relics of her short time on Earth. As his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he took in the sights and smells of his little girl's sanctuary. Her room was perfectly intact, as if some invisible force had protected it from the hundreds of indiscriminately fired rounds that shredded the rest of their home. As he sat there among his daughter's belongings, it was as if nothing bad had ever happened. A tiny ceramic impression of her newborn footprint sat on a shelf next to a framed photograph of their young family taken at her christening. He stood smiling in his only suit, holding Lucy in her heirloom gown. A beaming Lauren stood by his side in a black dress that complemented her fit frame, her arm around Reese's back. Damn, she looked beautiful. The photo brought him back to those 2 weeks of leave following a past deployment, when he was able to spend nearly every day with the two loves of his life. Looking back on it now, it was the happiest time of his life. Reese knew that he would never feel such happiness, pride, or contentment again. On Lucy's bed was a camouflage Team 7 blanket with her name, date of birth, and weight embroidered on it in pink, a gift from his troop. He ran his hand across the smooth fabric, feeling the threads where her name was written, just like he was touching the blonde curls on her head. He sat there for hours, taking in the sights and smells of his past in silent meditation. He didn't let outside thoughts invade his tranquility. This was time with his family. Reese made a few stops at various stores in San Diego the next day. A tuxedo shop, two electronics stores, a fabric retailer, and a hardware store. He paid cash for everything just to slow down any investigations that could be underway. He purchased a white tuxedo vest, a a yard of white nylon fabric, heavyweight thread, a box of 3-inch framing nails, insulated copper wire, a small wired light bulb, a silicone-controlled rectifier, a safe arm switch, a 9-volt battery, and 3 prepaid cell phones. Reese laid out the items from his shopping trip on the kitchen table of the safe house alongside Lauren's sewing machine, which he dug out of Lucy's closet after his vigil in her room. The Bernina machine had been a gift from his mother. Lauren, God love her, was not one for sewing, and he was sure that she'd never so much as plugged it in. He laid the white tuxedo vest on the table face down next to 2 M112 1.25-pound blocks of C4 plastic explosive. Using a fixed blade, Reese cut the wrapping from the 2 explosive blocks to expose the clay-like contents. The 2 blocks were combined into a single mass, which Reese rolled flat using a rolling pin. C4 is an extremely stable explosive that would need a lot more than a rolling pin to set it off. Even so, modifying military explosives was technically a violation of more than a few regulations, and having seen the mangled bodies of insurgents whose homemade concoctions went off ahead of schedule, Reese took his time. Pushing those thoughts aside, he continued to shape the mass until he was satisfied with its size and thickness. The nails came in strips of 25, designed to feed into a carpenter's nail gun. Reese placed the nail strips on top of the explosive and pressed them into the surface until the entire face was covered with steel. He then moved the explosive sheet onto the vest and covered it with the white nylon fabric. Using scissors, he cut the material until it covered the deadly mix and pinned it in place. This was going to be the hard part. Reese hadn't used a sewing machine since 9th grade home economics class, and he wasn't exactly a master at it then. Nearly every military unit had men who were gifted at sewing. Before the war created an entire industry of custom tactical nylon-focused gear companies, SEAL parachute riggers trained in sewing to repair parachutes would make side money customizing nylon gear for their teammates. Unfortunately, Reese had never spent much time in the rigger's loft learning that particular skill. The good news was that it didn't have to be pretty, it just had to hold everything together. After watching several YouTube videos on the basics of sewing, he fed the vest fabric into the machine. Reese was confident that his future career would not be as a tailor, but he got the job done, leaving a small opening on the bottom right-hand corner of the nylon. He tied off the heavy thread to secure the stitches. He held the vest upright to test his work, and to his relief, everything stayed in place. Next, Reese removed 2 of the 3 prepaid phones from their boxes and plugged both into their wall chargers. He used each phone to call the other to ensure that they functioned, that the numbers were correct, and that any cell phone carrier welcome texts or remote updates had all come through. He had seen even experienced terrorist bomb makers forget to do this and end up splattered across a wall when an unexpected text completed the circuit. Using a white paint marker, Reese drew a large X on one phone and wrote that phone's number on the back of the other. He also entered the phone number as a contact on the 2nd prepaid model. This is where things could get tricky. Reese wished he had an EOD tech to help him, but luckily information that would have been tightly controlled when he first entered the teams was now freely available to the world on the internet. He pried the back from the phone marked with an X and poked around until he could determine which wire did what. He identified those leading to the vibration mechanism and clipped them free of their attachment. Twisting the wires from the light bulb onto the vibrator wires and dialing the number that he'd placed into the other phone's contact list, the phone on the table began to ring, illuminating the bulb. Satisfied that sufficient electrical current was flowing from the detached wires, Reese added the safe arm switch, which controlled the flow of electricity from the phone to the more deadly end of the device, and tested it in the on and off positions to ensure it would break the circuit to the cap. He then wired in the silicone-controlled rectifier designed to hold back the energy until hit with a trickle of electricity that would allow the full charge into the cap. It was always hard for Reese to believe how these basic devices could cause such widespread terror and destruction, how a few hours of shopping could result in a mechanism for war. He disconnected the light and removed the battery from the phone, just to be safe. He then carefully removed a blasting cap from its plastic case and twisted its two wires onto those from the phone and 9-volt, wrapping the connected wires in electrical tape and slipping the device into the vest pocket. He pushed the blasting cap through the hole he'd left in the nylon fabric and buried it into the C4 inside. He double-checked everything to ensure that he hadn't made any errors, then hid the vest under